yes, there is a sense that the gold rush is over, but now I think there's also a bit of a shift towards finding parts of the stack that can be better optimized and really, the you know, reflective of the fact that people can only really spot these opportunities once they've kind of been in there for a while, understanding things, getting under the hood, and trying to like really understand what the true pain points are for the next phase of the US market. So that's I guess one sort of takeaway. Like, there's still opportunities. It's just that the opportunities look different now than they maybe did over the last few years.
This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Solutions, the leading iGaming PAM platform with a modular approach, including many benefits like a fast, secure, and scalable API-based platform integrated with all major third-party products and services. Make sure you head over to Pragmatic Solutions and join our smart thinking.
This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Play, a leading game developer providing player favorites to the most successful brands across the industry. With an award-winning multi-product portfolio of slots, live casino, bingo, virtual sports, and more, Pragmatic Play is powering up new possibilities of play through one single API. Visit pragmaticplay.com and discover your favorite every time.
And boom, we are live with Jesse Learmouth wearing one of the most exclusive snapback hats that you can possibly find in the world of snapback hack. The next.io snapback hat. Great to see you, Jesse. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, my friend. I've been honestly wearing the hell out of this hat since I got it at G2E. So I need a new one soon, Pierre, just to put that out there. I don't know if there's a new batch being produced, but this one's getting worn out due to overuse. But it's an awesome hat, man. I really like it.
Anything for you, Jesse. We'll keep that in mind for the next batch for sure. And I mean, it's been some time now since we sat down last time, Jesse. And as we've spoken about before, it's been great to get to know you through this journey. You're obviously running the most popular industry podcast over in the North American side of the industry, focused on startup landscape over there. And it's been great to follow your journey, Jesse. But first and foremost, just to kind of catch up a little bit here, you recently became a father for the first time here. And I can see that in your eyes, potentially, that you're you're a little bit more tired than usually, if I can be frankly honest here. But how's fatherhood?
Man, it is. So I guess, first of all, we're recording this on a Monday. So 2 weeks ago today, I became a father. So this is all very new to me still. It's been a short amount of time. But I think my sum total of it so far, Pierre, is like every cliche I've ever heard about parenthood is ringing true for me. You know, I've never like felt love like this before. It's a whole new sort of part of my heart that I've never sort of like felt kind of activate within me. We have a beautiful baby girl. She's extremely healthy. She's a happy baby. She's pretty chill. And we're just in love with her, my wife and I. So, I mean, it's just been amazing meeting her. And that moment will, you know, forever be one of the biggest moments in my life. And, you know, all the rest of it that comes with that, as you mentioned, my bleary eyes here. Yeah, the sleep has been a bit of a consequence of all of this. I am somebody who appreciates his 8 hours of sleep a night. And I don't know if I'll be having that again anytime soon, but doing my best here to adapt. But it's been amazing, man. And, you know, I've taken a couple of weeks off work. This conversation with you today is the first actual work commitment I've had since my daughter was born. So I'm a little bit rusty here and sleep deprived. So I'll do my very best to have a meaningful discussion here. But if I'm a little bit slow off the draw, maybe more so than usual, cut me a little bit of slack here. I'll do my best.
Oh, it's absolutely not a problem, my friend. We are happy to welcome the newest future entrepreneur of the iGaming industry to the world here. So exciting times ahead for sure, Jesse. I wanted to jump into to this topic directly. I mean, the topic of discussion today is, Jesse, you just put together an excellent startup report that gives a fantastic overview over the startup landscape, particularly in the North American landscape, where you interviewed X amount of startups and investors to get a good glimpse over the landscape over there. Can you talk about why you decided to put this startup report together?
Yeah, absolutely, Pierre. You know, the podcast of mine, it's a weekly podcast. So I have a lot of like what I call fragmented discussions, right? Like each conversation I have every week is what I call like a dot, which is in isolation. And you know, obviously a lot of conversations I have, I get different sentiment from different people and from different perspectives. And I have a hard time sometimes like tying it all together. Like each of these conversations is a dot in isolation, as I say. And I wanted to find a way to connect these dots to draw some directional lines for how the early stage ecosystem is actually doing. So I thought it would be interesting to leverage my network a little bit, and a lot of the founders I've spoken with over the last couple of years, reached out to them and asked if they'd be willing to complete a survey with quite a wide range of questions. And I sent out the survey in early January. I think I sent it out to about 125 different founders in my database, and just over half of them actually responded to it. And it wasn't a short survey. I mean, it probably took each of them 10 to 15 minutes to complete. So it was a bit of a big ask. I wasn't really sure what type of response I would get to it. And was extremely thrilled and grateful to get the level of response that I did. And not only the level of response, but the fact that many of them were very candid with some of the thoughts that they shared, and also some of the data they shared as well, right? I mean, again, we week over week read a lot about funding announcements and M&A activity, and each of these transactions has, you know, some number attached to them, but like tying it all together and trying to get sort of aggregate numbers to try and quantify things a little bit, I wanted to be able to try and do that. So I'm very, as I say, pleased to have gotten the level of response that I did. And I've aggregated all of the responses and all of the data, and just putting the final touches on a report that we're going to be sending out here hopefully later this week. And, you know, it's going to shine a little bit of a light, I think, on the realities for a lot of the entrepreneurs that are operating in the space right now, and not only celebrating a lot of the wins that many of the teams are experiencing, but also facing a lot of the realities that there's a lot of challenges out there right now. And, you know, again, a lot of them are very forthcoming with the pains that they're experiencing right now. And it was very interesting to kind of get that sentiment from every perspective. So yeah, I don't think anything has really been produced quite like this before. And, you know, I sent you a little bit of a sneak preview of it with some of the content. And I think it's going to provide a very interesting window into the realities of the early stage ecosystem within the industry right now. So excited to get it out here in the coming days.
So if you were to kind of summarize this report into an executive summary, what would you say that summary would be?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess just to provide a little bit of context around it just before I answer, you know, the respondents were predominantly from the US. So again, I think 68 startups completed the survey, of which 45-ish were from the US. So I'm not good at math right now. Again, back to the sleep deprivation, but I don't know, 2/3 or whatever, or 3/4 are from the US. So it has a very sort of US-centric, I think, perspective to it. And I guess through that lens, you know, one of the major takeaways for me is that there is a certain amount of, I don't know if frustration is the right word, but certainly like cynicism right now from a lot of the founders about the space in general, which to me was honestly the most surprising thing, especially when you consider the fact that like entrepreneurs in their nature are meant to be enthusiastic and hopeful and really building for the future and trying to, you know, be the disruptors in their space. But, you know, a lot of the responses really suggested otherwise. And there is this like level of just overall like frustration. You know, a couple just maybe anecdotes around that. Like, you know, there was a lot of commentary around how, you know, particularly for the B2B startups in this space, like a lot of the incumbents right now, the operators are very slow to embrace change and innovation. And consequently, you know, integration roadmaps remain long, which is obviously the lifeblood for any B2B startup trying to break through and get product market fit. So that was definitely a well-cited challenge right now. On the capital side, I mean, it's no surprise. We talk about this all the time on every industry podcast that, you know, the capital environment remains tough. But interestingly, I think one of the things specifically within the context of this report that I took is that there's a perception right now that capital is concentrated really to sort of a couple dozen-ish people or firms that are really actively writing checks in this space. And in the aggregate, there is this sort of perception that this group is perceived as, you know, quote unquote insiders that really can control the fate of a startup. I take that one with a little bit of a grain of salt because, again, you know, an open-ended survey response, you know, could be from people who have received a no from some of these investors. So this survey could be a bit of an outlet for them to express some of the frustration. So I do discount that sentiment a little bit, but that being said, like that was a bit of a prevailing theme. And, you know, again, just for B2B companies, especially, just a lot of general frustration about the length of the sales cycle, integration timelines, and to some extent, the commercial models that many of the operators are signing on for now, which maybe isn't necessarily aligned with what a lot of the startups had sort of hoped for, maybe at the start of their journey. So in aggregate, I think like one of the key takeaways is, again, just like a bit of a level of like, you know, malaise right now, I suppose I would call it. That being said, that's not a universal sentiment. I mean, there's a lot of very, very, you know, exciting case studies from the report, and a lot of companies are absolutely crushing it right now. I don't want to take away from that, but just to cast it all with a wide brush, I mean, yeah, a little bit of a sense of frustration, I think, is kind of what I gathered at a very high level.
Right. And, you know, looking at one of the questions that you posed in the survey was the year of the inception of the company, of the founders. And I took note here that around 60%, even more, a little bit more than 60% was founded either 2021 or earlier. So during this very this very happy period of investors not being shy to deploy capital, right? And very aggressively, that strategy have changed, right? Do you think potentially that this kind of cynicism is born out of founders who took that period a little bit for granted, perhaps? Whereas now actually we're moving into normalcy. Not exactly that that the investment landscape had dried up. It's more that we are entering some form of normal state again in that space.
Yeah, I think that definitely plays into it to some degree, Pierre. And I mean, you're right, like those years were the exception, right? They weren't the norm. And for maybe some new entrepreneurs that have never started a business before, that didn't have more historical context around how, you know, how economic cycles work in sort of a broader lens. I mean, that to them may have seemed like the norm, and it's actually the inverse of that, right? So we are returning to normalcy, which I think is actually a net positive and a very healthy thing. But, you know, the fallout from that is, yeah, there's some frustrated entrepreneurs out there that are now facing the prospect of either constrained capital for continuing to extend their own runways, or, you know, for those that can secure new capital, they're facing potential down rounds, right? They raised that, in many cases, very excessive valuations in those years you mentioned. And, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost, and it's tough out there. So there's a bit of that definitely playing into it. Just to quantify it here a little bit, from the respondents of my survey, those that answered the question about the amount of capital raised, which was most of them, the cumulative amount of capital raised from the survey respondents was over $250 million, right? So this is like, wow, this is significant money, $250 million we're talking about. And interestingly, when I looked a bit further down the survey and look at how that capital has translated into both revenue and EBITDA, there's a massive gap there, right? Like the amount of capital raised is $250 million, yet for the year of 2023, there was, what was it here? 72% of the respondents generated less than $500,000 in top line revenue in 2023, right? So like we're not talking top line revenue. And then somewhat incredibly, a small single digit number of respondents generated over $500,000 in EBITDA, right? So talking about profitability, like, you know, profitability remains elusive. So, you know, large amounts of capital in, not necessarily translating into revenue, and certainly not translating into profitability. And I think a lot of the frustration maybe that I'm sensing from some of the responses is reflective of that reality, right? And, you know, part of that is down to the availability of capital, but also part of that is, you know, incumbent upon the entrepreneurs themselves to, you know, make sure that they're operating with sound business fundamentals, that their plans are actually reflective of the environment around them, and that they're building things that are actually in need, not necessarily things that they want for themselves. So there's a few aspects at play here, but, you know, broad strokes, you know, there's some tough conversations, certainly, I'm sure, being had within a lot of these companies right now.
Yeah, and to your point, Jesse, another question here was also at what percentage of these companies have actually raised capital in the first place? And the way it's being formulated and phrased in the survey, it is that either you have external funding or you have operated your company bootstrapped. But it implies that, you know, just like if you raise capital, I mean, you should also operate your business bootstrapped until you are profitable, at least, you know, and maybe a lot of these organizations have raised a lot of capital and spent part of that capital in luxury spending, let's say, that they have gotten accustomed to, not realizing that in order to take your company from funding to profitability, you need to approach that in a really bootstrapped and careful way, perhaps. And it's difficult to make that transition from a company that is now accustomed to and has a culture of luxury spending to then switch to being bootstrapped, right? Like, that's a challenge that many companies face, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that really comes down to just like organizational DNA, right? I mean, if you're building a company from day one with a mindset and attitude of, you know, operate lean, scrappy, you know, do things creatively, just do what needs to be done. You know, those companies are going to be well positioned to weather whatever storms they might face. Whereas, as you rightly point out, I mean, the ones that maybe got caught up in a little bit of the exuberance of the low interest rate environment, I mean, you know, that's a tough adaptation to make. Once you've gotten a taste of that sort of, you know, organizational culture, it's really tough to shift that and right size it. And, you know, look, I mean, these realities aren't, I should point out, like, aren't exclusive to the early stage ecosystem within the iGaming industry, right? I mean, we're even seeing, you know, on public markets and in the FAANG companies, right? There's a lot of right sizing happening there in broader tech. And a lot of that is traced back to the overhiring that happened in the low interest rate environments of 2020 and 2021. So, you know, a lot of companies are struggling with this right now, but you're absolutely right. Like, once that culture becomes entrenched, it's just so challenging and difficult to shift it. And, you know, there's a few examples I can probably think of within the industry of companies that have successfully managed that transition and managed that shift. But by and large, a lot of them are still struggling to sort of live in the era of 3 years ago, while facing the realities of today, which is a much different world, of course.
Exactly. And I think this is like a classical example of, you know, you raise capital and so clearly your mind is in growth. It's a growth mindset. You want to make sure to employ faster, to get more people on board, to grow faster, to launch your product or grow your top line revenues as quick as possible, without kind of auditing on how much money are you spending or how much resources are you bringing onto the organization. Compared with the revenue that you are generating or the products that you are taking on. And I think a lot of companies are waking up to the fact that, say that they have employed 100 people and now they are faced with a decision where maybe they have a difficulty raising capital. So either you right-size the company down to 50 people and try to still produce 90% of the output, or there is no other option. And I think when you are put with those very simple black and white options, you find a way to make it happen, right? Like, you don't have, when you don't have that pressure on you in the day-to-day, it's easy, I think, to bloat the company somewhat or to become a little bit lazy in how you operate the company from a day-to-day. But when it's life and death, you find a way to get to that number where you can be more sustainable as an organization. And but it takes a mindset change, and it, through that process comes a bit cynicism as well, because maybe you got used to raising capital through several rounds, and when that access to capital is not that readily available anymore, you know, at first you feel that it maybe is a bit unfair, or that investors are dragging out that process too long, and so on. But then eventually you just have to come to that conclusion. You just have to find that that plan B in order to stay afloat.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, I should do a keyword cluster analysis on some of the survey responses here. But one word that, like, I kept seeing in some of the responses was the word survival, right? And I think a lot of the entrepreneurs in this space now are saying, like, you know what, like, it's basically survival at all costs, right? And survival can mean many different things. It can include a pivot. It could include some, you know, potential M&A or what, you know, soft landings, if you will. But like, there really is now this like prevailing mindset of like survival at all costs. So to your point, you know, it's no longer, growth at all costs, it's survival at all costs. And I think that to me is also one of the net takeaways now. And again, those that are able to sort of make that shift within their organizations are going to be able to survive. But, you know, some won't. And that's probably a healthy shakeout that needs to happen inevitably anyway. So we'll see how it unfolds and manifests. But it definitely is, you know, survival mode out there right now for many of them.
Survival of the fittest, that's for sure. Yeah. So Jesse, if we just kind of zoom out a bit, from your perspective, how do you feel about the startup landscape at the moment, especially from a US lens, if you will. You obviously have the survey at your disposal, but you also have these isolated points of conversation that perhaps are a little bit more open as well to you. Like, how do you feel about the landscape?
Yeah, a couple thoughts there to share. You know, I think first of all, one of the major takeaways, I mean, I felt this anyways, but I think the survey just kind of like really hammered a point home for me, which is that the idea that the quote unquote gold rush of the US market is more or less over in the post-PASPA era. Look, over the first few years post-PASPA, we saw many entrepreneurs come into the space thinking that, you know, this is a high growth category with a lot of low hanging fruit. There's a lot of like, you know, sexy opportunities to pursue. And we attracted a lot of new entrepreneurs to the space to try and pursue those opportunities. And I would say that if that was true then, sentiment seems to be that it's no longer true, or certainly that window is closing. And, you know, there is a bit of a shift away now from, you know, like, let's be honest here. Like, we probably don't need another DFS company out there, right? Like, the landscape is, the market's saturated. We have lots of options out there right now. I think a lot of like the quote unquote like sexy opportunities are no longer there. That all being said, I think there's a very interesting shift now coming where some of the companies, and we got some responses to the survey to this effect, which is that some of the companies had a go-to-market strategy or a go-to-market product that they ended up pivoting away from in favor of finding something much, quote unquote, like less sexy. And really, like, as they got a little bit of experience in the space and better understood a lot of the nuances and intricacies of how operators actually operate and like what goes into being an operator at scale and all of the underlying component parts to it, I think a lot of entrepreneurs saw opportunity to, you know, find little wedges within the stack where, you know, maybe some of the operators were challenged. And we've seen a lot of like very interesting, you know, stuff come out of like RegTech is an obvious one right now that a lot of people talk about as a category, which is, let's be honest, a little less sexy than, you know, a consumer facing app or something like that. So yes, there is a sense that the gold rush is over, but now I think there's also a bit of a shift towards finding parts of the stack that can be better optimized and really the, you know, reflective of the fact that people can only really spot these opportunities once they've kind of been in there for a while, understanding things, getting under the hood and trying to like really understand what the true pain points are for the next phase of the US market. So that's, I guess, one sort of takeaway. Like, there's still opportunities. It's just that the opportunities look different now than they maybe did over the last few years. The other thing I would say is that there is, I think, a little bit more of a, I guess I'll call a, I don't know, a willingness to explore consolidation and M&A at an earlier stage for some startup companies where, you know, maybe they have, you know, raised money at high valuations a few years ago and are running out of runway. You know, the go it alone strategy obviously was, you know, part of their plan, but you know, the realities now are that maybe a soft landing isn't such a bad outcome after all. Maybe getting, you know, a win through a joint venture or an acqui-hire or something like this, you know, could set them up for their next at bat. And you know, that I think there's a bit of a prevailing sentiment that like that's not such a bad thing. You know, everybody's obviously wanting to swing for the fences and get the home run. I'm really overdoing the baseball metaphor here, by the way. But you know, the reality is like, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for just. You know, getting some points on the board here. And there's a real, I think, acknowledgement of that now, whereas maybe in the last few years, we didn't hear as much about consolidation or M&A at the earlier stage. Certainly in the conversations I have, you know, that seems to be a much more available path to many companies now. So it'll be interesting to see how that manifests itself in the coming months here. I mean, you know, there's certainly been, you know, proliferation of funding announcements in the first, what is it, 6 weeks of 2024. But I wouldn't be the least bit surprised to start seeing a lot more announcements around M&A or joint ventures or things to that effect where, you know, 1+1=3 could be an outcome for a startup that, you know, maybe has to adapt its original plan of going it alone based on its original business plan from 2021.
Right, and we've seen definitely a lot of announcements recently of kind of incumbents that are either investing or acquiring smaller organizations here, perhaps to reach some form of product differentiation strategy. Like OpenBet announced today that they are making. Oh no, they did not announce yet. It is a rumor.
Rumors.
Actually, that OpenBet is about to make a strategic investment in Stripe. as reported by Earnings and More, by the way, should be mentioned. So just a rumor at this stage. Obviously, Light and Wonder made a strategic investment into Flows, good friends of ours, with James King at the helm. FanDuel acquiring Carolina Pelk's Beyond Play recently as well. So there seems to be an uptick in this type of announcement and strategic investments and acquisitions from major incumbents of the industry. And I can only imagine that will continue now. It seems like the incumbents are looking more and more into these more strategic investments at the moment, to your point, perhaps, because it is difficult oftentimes for the smaller organizations to find investments. So naturally, they seek themselves to kind of the major incumbents for product market fit, it seems like. So Jesse, another question I have for you is a little bit of a selfish question, perhaps. As a conference organizer, an event organizer of the last 10 years, I was very happy to see that you dedicated part of this survey to the conference landscape here with a couple of questions. So selfishly, I would like to ask you, what were the findings when it came to the interest around the conference landscape?
Yeah, so I wanted to create a bit of space for this question within the survey, because the reality is, and I mean, we've talked about this before, and everybody knows this, which is that there are arguably too many conferences these days, certainly more than any one person or one company can reasonably attend all of. So it really it's a forcing function for people to be very discriminatory in terms of which they are investing their money and their time in attending, and particularly for companies at the early stage who notoriously have very limited budgets, they want to understand where they can best maximize their ROI from attending conferences. And, you know, there was some interesting takeaways from this, Pierre, and I'm happy you found it interesting and, of course, relevant to Next.io. I guess the caveat that is that, you know, the sentiment is from the perspective of startups, which isn't necessarily reflective of other stakeholder types that conferences attract. But that being said, like a couple top level takeaways is that, again, there's too many conferences for startups on a shoestring budget. They really must be hyper selective about which ones they attend. And consequently, the startups are really looking for conferences that have some dedicated space to their segment. There's conferences with pitch competitions and to some degree, investor networking, but there really seems to be like a dearth of conferences that are really dedicated to startups. And I guess this ties nicely back to Next NYC. I would have it that Next NYC is probably, from a US perspective, the one conference which really is dedicated to connecting startups to, influential stakeholders in the space, be it capital sources or operators or other, other incumbents that they may wish to be making connections with. So, the other interesting thing I think that I took from it is that a bit of a perception for startups that start, the conferences can be a little bit difficult for newcomers to break into. They're perceived a little bit as a hangout for people that are already like on the quote unquote inside. So there's a little bit of perception there that maybe we as an industry need to work on with our conferences and creating more dedicated space for startups, making them feel more welcomed and encouraged to come, and not necessarily over-indexing conference content or conference agendas to the incumbents who, let's be honest, are the ones that are probably putting up the sponsorship dollars for the event, right? There's this perception that there's a bit of a gap of dedicated space for startups. That's something I think that, event organizers could potentially look to as a differentiator for themselves. Interestingly though, Pierre, like the corollary to that, and we got this in the survey as well, is that, you got to do the work, right? Like to be on the inside, you got to do the work to put yourself on the inside. And a few of the entrepreneurs cited that within their responses, which is that they've been going to these things, they go to five or six conferences a year, they've been doing it for 3 years straight. And only now do they feel like, they know the major influences within the space that are relevant to their business. And it's just that sheer grit and effort to just consistently show up, right? So yes, we could be a bit more inclusive perhaps to startups, but also it is somewhat incumbent on the entrepreneurs themselves to get out there, put in the work, boots on the ground, a little bit of hustling. And one survey response put it very well, quote, they said, you got to create your own luck. And I really like that. That really resonated with me because it's true, right? They're like, you can be lucky and have one or two very meaningful interactions at a conference, but also to some degree, you have to create your own luck. And I mean, that's true true in life, but certainly when it comes to the conference circuit, that is as true as anything for people that are newer to it. So yeah, a lot of interesting insights there, but I think, you know, a lot of it really spoke to the value that you and your team are creating with Next NYC particularly.
Yeah, it's a great insight, the kind of create your own luck statement. And I think that's something we can all learn from when it comes to visiting conferences and getting the most out of them, is that sometimes it happens once in a blue moon that you just have this stroke of quotation mark luck, where you just bump into the right person, you have the right conversation, and that changes the track for your entire company, or you manage to set that deal eventually as an account manager that you have always been looking for, that's going to elevate you within your organization or whatever it may be. But the point is more that if you put yourself out there, if you have as many conversations as you can, you're putting yourself in a place where luck is inevitable eventually, because it's a numbers game at the conferences. You need to speak to as many people as you possibly can. But then from us as event organizers, our job is to facilitate those conversations to take place. It should be as easy as possible to be able to have as many kind of spontaneous conversations as you can, right? And that's always a bit of a challenge for us, because the standard kind of go-to format is that, you know, you want to just create a platform, a bit of a marketplace, some exhibition stands where people can just kind of put them in a place and let them do their thing, kind of thing. But if we can alleviate those conversations to take place by, for example, you know, speed dating events, for example, it could be other just activity-based events. You know, in Next NYC, we're organizing a run club that is followed by a breakfast, you know, and that's for sure is going to connect those people who are attending that event, for example. And that is kind of the next level of thinking when you organize events, that is kind of like, you know, this 80-20 rule. It takes 20% of the time to produce 80% of the work, but it's those last 20% that takes 80% of the time that creates the magic when it comes to the event, like those magic moments at the event. And it's important not to forget that as an event organizer, I think. And so I think that's an excellent quote in general. You do create your own luck at the end of the day, but you need to put yourself out there to as many conversations as you possibly can, even if it's uncomfortable sometimes.
100%, Pierre. And I will add one more thing here. I'm just scrolling through my notes to find it. I want to make sure I get it right. I did ask a question in the survey as well. Again, forced, because look, I get a lot of questions from founders reach out to me, say, hey, like, so many conferences, which ones should I go to? So I'm sort of forced often to say, okay, I think these are the best ones for a startup to go to, might be the best ROI for you. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to ask this question in the survey. What is the best conference for an early stage founder in the space to attend? I will quickly name drop that the first one was G2E Las Vegas. 23.5% of respondents cited that one. But right behind it, the second most valuable conference for founders in the space is Next NYC. So, I mean, we're coming up on the third installment of this show, Pierre, and already it has leapfrogged many of the other large global conferences as being the single best one to go to for startups in the space to, you know, establish those key relationships that you've talked about and get that face time with the people who otherwise, you know, they may not ever have access to. And I think there's a very high surface area of influential people you've created within the space at Next NYC. And for any entrepreneur looking to maximize the surface area from their time at a conference, like, I'm really hard pressed to think of a better event than this one. I'm not paid to say this, by the way. This is genuine. I'm just here to create value for the founders in the space. But I mean, really, truly, like, to get that reflected in the survey responses, like, already there is a perception out there that this show is the one to be at for really generating that value for people that are trying to break onto the inside, right? Like, this is where you go to get to the inside if you're currently thinking you're on the outside still.
Well, you're a great hype man, Jesse. I'll give you that. If this betting startup thing doesn't work out for you, I can recommend you a thing or two over here. But yeah, fantastic to hear that, Jesse. I mean, it makes an old man's heart feel really warm there. So thank you for that. I really appreciate that. Jesse, let's turn the tables here a little bit. You know, you've created a really cool and really unique kind of organic network between startups and investors, and just generally key industry players, particularly over in the North American side. I know that you also have a great network over here in Europe as well, but you're obviously North American based, and that's where the network started. So I'm really curious to understand a little bit more, Jesse, from your point of view. You have, whoever, you know, without throwing too many compliments here back and forth, but whenever your name comes up, it's always in kind of positive sentences. And you have created a really good network, as you mentioned. How do you plan to leverage this network? Because you have a quite unique opportunity here to do some really cool things. I'm really curious to understand a bit more what you are building towards.
I mean, look, it's a great question, Pierre. I think probably you asked me this a year ago or whenever I was last on the podcast. I didn't have a great answer then, and I don't have much of a better one today. But look, I think the, like, zooming out a little bit from the question directly just for a moment here, like I much like you, like, just have passion for this space and for this industry, and have just over the last 2.5 years really been trying to just do whatever I can to create goodwill within it, and giving a lot, honestly. Like, I'm not really monetizing my time probably in the way I could or should, but I've really been trying to just give a little bit and have a little bit of faith that at some point maybe that will come back in some way that maybe right now is a little bit too abstract to put definition around, but know that when the time comes, you know, I could probably call in, I don't know, favors or sort of ask for a favor back, and it will come. I think a little bit of like Gary Vaynerchuk's book, Jab, 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 Right Hook, right? I don't know if you've read that one, but it's this whole, the whole concept there, just in short, is like, you know, he's all about like give, which is the jab part of the title. But then at some point, you know, you sort of put yourself out there and you try and create value so much so that when it's time to ask for something, people are very willing to give it back to you. And that's the right hook part of it. So I don't have my right hook figured out quite yet. That all being said, like, I'm continuously evaluating ideas. And I think one thing I guess I will say is that over the last 2.5 years, I've very much operated as like a lone wolf. Like, I've been doing all of this on my own. I've very much, I think, and not particularly with the arrival of my little one, like, really have come to terms with the fact that, like, you know, if you want to go far, you need to go together, sort of thing. I forget what the actual figure of speech is there, but I am thinking a little bit now about what does it look like to build out, you know, a small team around me to provide me support to do more, like, because there's so much I want to do. There's so much more I can be doing and should be doing. There's a lot of low hanging fruit with I guess the beachhead I've created with a lot of this. And there's a lot more to do, but I'm facing the ceiling of my own limitations with time and capacity and just like bandwidth. So, you know, I need to abandon my lone wolf strategy at some point here and think about how do I continue to grow and nurture the ecosystem in the way I've been doing it, in a way that I'm not constrained by my own limitations as one person. So thinking a bit about that, and you know, I guess I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing, man. I mean, that's the honest answer. And look, you know, I've started advising a couple startups in the space, having a lot of fun doing that. And like, part of me being a lone wolf, that's been a challenge for me, is that I'm, I think, inherently a pretty extroverted person. All my best work I've ever done in my career has been with teams and with people. And, you know, arguably like my best work has been leading teams. And as a lone wolf, like, I don't get to do that. And there's like a part of me missing when I'm just sitting here like as one person. So I really want to get back to working with the team, and how that manifests itself, whether it's continuing to advise some of these startups, whether it's, you know, creating and building my own team around me to scale what I'm already doing in a more smart way. You know, we'll see, I think, over the coming months here. But, you know, I'm at a point in life now where I'm, you know, I'm ready to kind of take a leap from this being a little bit of a hobby project and building a little bit of a business around it. I don't have, you know, huge ambition per se to build a large scale business, but something that might be considered like a lifestyle business to me. You know, that would make me happy, right? Like, as long as I can sustain myself and my team and my people, and, you know, we're all happy and healthy and showing up every day doing work that fulfills us, like, that to me is winning. And, you know, if some amount of like quantifiable success comes with that, great. If not, you know, that's fine too. But I don't have like big ambitions with a big plan right now. I mean, as you well know through our discussions, is like, I've been doing this very organically. I'm going to continue to do it organically, albeit try and get a little bit smarter about how I can scale some of these activities I've been doing, because I'm not short on ideas. I am very short on my ability to execute on them, though. So we'll see. We'll see here. But a little bit of a teaser, I guess, for some things maybe that are coming up in the coming months for me.
Right. And I think the best businesses are built on this organic foundation, where the founder didn't necessarily try to force themselves into a product market fit or finding the right opportunity and the right time. But usually what happens with really successful businesses is that they're just really passionate for their idea or their product they want to build without really thinking about the opportunities that lie ahead. Because the truth is that many businesses starting out will become something different in the future if they are successful. And building that organic base in the organization where you are, we talked about this in your podcast as well, where you're firing bullets rather than cannons, right? So having the ability to try to break things, to take a step back, to try a couple of new things, and eventually you find that opportunity that really accelerates the organization. I could just say in our case, for example, we started our business in 2013, I think. And me and Martin, my co-founder, we just loved organizing events, right? We quit our jobs and we just wanted to organize events. That was our passion. And Martin had organized some kind of like side events for a while. And I was the event manager for Betsson Group at that time. So I did events for other companies. And we just decided that if we have free reign to do our own thing, it will be so much fun to do it. And the first couple of years, we operated as lone wolves as well. And it took us 8 years before we went from kind of operating on a passion level, kind of getting by, but also being a bit bootstrapped, you know, making probably one quarter of the money that we could have done if we worked full time for another organization. And it took 8 years to go from that to deciding that now we want to raise capital and commit ourselves to what is today Next.io. But our business started as party organization, you know, here in Malta. We organized the best parties on the island and we had a lot of good times doing that, right? But then at some point, you know, we kind of matured and we found something else, and that turned out to be our business. You know, I'm so happy that through the years when we navigated that period, we didn't really try to force anything. We could have committed ourselves to something very different early on and kind of stuck with that, but it would have been probably not the greatest idea for us. But instead, we stuck out. And whenever the opportunity came, we jumped on it, like when an organic opportunity came. And I think I get the feeling that you are on that journey as well, Jesse, where you have been experimenting in this couple of years. You have been building steadily. You have been building a great name, great database, great reputation. And you have gotten to the point where you have so many different options that eventually it is written in stone that it's going to lead to that one big opportunity eventually. I have a feeling of that for sure.
No, I love the next story as well. A lot of what you just said resonates with me. And I mean, look, we've just been talking about a lot of startups that are cynical and struggling right now because they've put themselves on that treadmill very early on in their own trajectories. And, you know, once you're on that treadmill, it's really difficult to step off. So the longer one can bootstrap and the longer one can organically find their way to product market fit, whatever that ends up looking like, those are the ones that will have the optionality when and if they so choose to take whatever path forward they want for themselves, right? And that's all I'm building towards here. You know, for you and Martin, that's what you did. And now, you know, you guys are on a trajectory that you're on. And it's largely because of that, you know, the 8 years you put in at the beginning there to find your, you know, your path. So, you know, I have huge respect for people that are willing to take that approach. It's certainly not the most glamorous one. It's not very sexy. It's, as you rightly say, like you forego a lot of short-term opportunity. There's opportunity cost, right? I mean, you know, arguably could be, you know, working somewhere for many multiples greater salary than whatever I'm drawing in from meager sponsorship dollars on the podcast right now. But that's okay, right? I know it's all going to lead to something on my own schedule, and I'm perfectly happy with that. And as I said, like for me, at least at this stage of like my life and where I'm at, like I'm really optimizing for fulfillment, right, not achievement. And as long as I can retain the fulfillment aspect to whatever I'm doing, like that's it, and we're just going to keep going, and good things will happen with time. And staying healthy and staying in the game for as long as possible remains the goal now, and good things will happen if we can do that. So brick by brick, day by day, that's it, gonna keep building over here.
That's it, my friend. And so if you look at the industry landscape overall right now, Jesse, like what are some like key trends that you are paying attention to right now, particularly from a North American point of view?
Yeah, so I spend, I mean, most of my time, I guess, within the sports betting vertical. So my answer will be very much in that context. Key trends right now, there's a lot of talk about like operator consolidation, but I think a downstream effect of that, which is manifesting itself now, but is going to only, I think, come into greater focus as time passes here, is the practice of many of the operators insofar as limiting or restricting player accounts. That obviously has been a practice from a risk management perspective with operators around the globe for as long as online sports betting has existed. But from a US perspective, this is really, I think, coming into greater focus. And maybe it's sort of the corners of Twitter that I hang out on where, you know, gambling Twitter, and you get a lot of people sort of sharing screenshots of the of their, you know, their accounts with like the message popping up saying, hey, you're restricted to $2 per bet now. I think there's a reckoning coming at some point. I don't quite know when that's going to come or what that looks like. But, you know, for an industry that is talking a lot about its future growth potential right now, I think there's a lot of a little bit of like self-sabotage happening where, you know, instead of actually, you know, properly managing risk as a sportsbook should, you know, they're very quick to just basically close accounts that show any amount of sharpness or whatnot. And I think there's something coming there. And I think, I guess, a downstream effect of that, and to your question around like the trends I see, there's a massive, I think, emergence right now within what I'm calling like the betting tools ecosystem. There's dozens and dozens of really excellent apps, software, tools out there that are helping educate the population on, you know, some basic strategies and tactics for betting more smartly, and if not necessarily betting profitably, at least betting in a way where you'll extend your bankroll for longer, you'll stay in the game longer, you basically won't lose your money as fast as you will without some of these tools, right? And, you know, the push on the marketing side by many operators to push like same game parlays so aggressively because they are, you know, 20, 30% margin products, like that is, you know, that's not a recipe for sustainability. So I just feel like there's a bit of a reckoning coming. Again, I don't quite know what it looks like yet, but there's this like confluence of things happening that suggests to me that there is, you know, a bit of a, I don't know, a bit of like a pushback coming from the players out there who are feeling like they are already betting at a disadvantage with a lot of the margin that the operators are baking into their odds. But now not only are they disadvantaged with the margins, but now if they show some level of success with their betting, they're basically getting the access completely cut off, right? And there's a fairness aspect to that. There's a lot of questions around like operators, I don't know, capability when it comes to risk management. That all being said, there are some great operators in the US right now that are sort of leaning into that and taking that as their own USP, Circa Sports being one of them, Prime Sports, a newer operator launched in Ohio last fall. These guys are sort of leaning into that narrative a little bit and saying, hey, you know, we're here to serve these people that are getting restricted and cut off by the more retail operators out there. So there's just something happening there, which as a trend line, it's a little bit abstract right now, Pierre, but I really like can't go a day without seeing some sort of like anecdote around this narrative. I guess that's the biggest thing for me right now, is sort of like the confluence of all of this. A bit of a rambly answer, but yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense.
I like it, Jesse. I'll give you just an interesting story here to give a little bit more context on the kind of high margin products that are being pursued by the operator. So I'll tell you a funny story. So there's a European game supplier. I'm not going to name who it is, but so over here in Europe, when it comes to roulette, we have the European roulette, right? And the European roulette is a single zero roulette with fairly low margin to the operator, right? And that's what you traditionally will see in a European casino, is a single zero roulette, European roulette, basically. Whereas over in North America, the American roulette with a double zero is more standard, right? So if you go into any casino in Vegas or anywhere else or online for that matter, the double zero is what you traditionally will see. So as a European, it always hurts a bit to go to especially for me, who is a roulette player, that's my preferred game. It hurts a little bit to go to the casino and see a double zero there, knowing that the odds are definitely not in my favor. So here comes the interesting thing. When this European game supplier was going to establish themselves in North America, they brought the single zero roulette to the online market. and the online operators were begging for the double zero, to which the game supplier first refused. And they said, you know, we're not going to do that to our players. We think that the single zero is a big USP for the players to prefer to play online rather than go to the brick and mortar casino. But the North American operators insisted on the double zero. And so what the game supplier did was to say, fine, okay, let's make an experiment. We'll place the single zero European roulette next to the American double zero roulette, and we'll compare how many players will play each product. And what do you think happened? Well, most American players preferred the American double zero roulette because that's what they are accustomed to. That's what they know. That's what they trust, I suppose, even though the single zero roulette was actually much better for them odds-wise. And it just kind of goes to show that, unfortunately, I suppose, the player isn't really that educated in what games are actually better for themselves, right? So to these kind of high-margin games, I would hope that in the future, we as an industry can help to educate the players on which games or kind of like what they should be looking for if they can compare kind of operator to operator and what margins are better than others and so on to create a more sustainable market. Because at the end of the day, the operator, if the player is asking for the American roulette, the operator is very happy to give that to them, yeah. Right? But if the players would be asking for the European roulette and you as an operator are not offering that, but you are competitor does, then obviously the player should be moving to that competitor and it should be an advantage to offer better odds. But that doesn't seem to be the case today.
Yeah, well, look, as a fellow roulette enthusiast, I'll call myself. I don't know if you've seen this, Pierre. Last year, I was over in Vancouver with my wife. We went to an NHL game. And after the game, we went to the local casino in downtown Vancouver. And I was shocked to discover there is now a version of roulette with a triple zero on the board.
Triple zero, yeah. Going, I think in Vegas, too.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, I was like, wow, yeah. are we there now? God. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, 10% margin. Like, it's crazy. Yeah. Triple zero. I saw even... There was a proposal from someone opening a live studio with a quadruple zero. I don't know how many zeros you can fit in a roulette wheel, but the triple zero is extortionate. Honestly, it's really hard to win if you play with a triple zero. I mean, for a long session.
But maybe for a long session, but maybe to your point though, like I saw the triple zero on the board and I understand inherently the math behind it, but did that stop me from playing roulette? No, I played anyway. Of course I did. So.
Played anyway. Okay, quick question here. Which is your lucky number for when you play roulette?
It's my roulette strategy, I call it, Pierre. I don't like to tell it to people because you know it's my edge that I have. Right. But I will say number 15.
All right, number 15. Jesse, there's an objectively right answer to this question. Okay, this is not a subjective thing. They objectively right number to play on roulette is ocho. Everything is surrounding ocho. Number 8. That's the magic number in roulette. Trust me, this is a secret advice from your fellow European friend here.
I'll put that into practice on the next time I'm in front of a triple zero board. We'll try it out.
Right. A/B test. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Or you can pursue the magical martingale strategy and win small amounts of money until you lose your whole life. But that's another mathematical story. Yeah. So Jesse, as a bit of a final question here for you today, mm-hmm. You have a traditional question that you ask all of your guests, and I would really like to ask this question back to you today. So if we would turn the tables around here for a moment, if you did not work in the real money gaming industry, what would you do instead?
Wow, tables have turned indeed. By the way, just before I answer that, Pierre, I had episode 100 recently, and I declared in episode 100 that I was going to retire that as my standard closing question. So I actually need to find a new standard closing question. If you have any ideas for me, let me know. But I will answer that. It's funny, somewhat ironically, like growing up, I always said that like what I wanted to do was move to a tropical island or a tropical place and run a beachside bar. But then in my 30s, I got the opportunity to move to Curaçao, which is a tropical island. And I spent lots of time at Beachside Bar as well on Curaçao. So I got a little bit of like experience there. And now, I guess, with that experience, I'm like, I don't know if that's something I actually like want to do in my parallel universe. So I'll slightly reframe my answer to it. And I think like I think about that in the context of the fact that I spend all my time right now in this industry, which is very global. And it's been, you know, amazing to make so many like meaningful, lasting connections with people from all around the world and do work that like transcends borders. So like on a very big global scale, like is where I spend most of my time. So I think like in a parallel universe, like I'd actually go the other direction and do something very local and really focus more on my energy and effort, like cultivating relationships within my local community, which frankly isn't something I spend a heck of a lot of time doing. And I guess how would that manifest itself? I think I joke to my wife about this sometimes. I'm like, you know, I like a good cup of coffee. And I think I'd probably open a coffee shop in my local town here and just like get to know the people in my town, completely removed from the real money gaming industry, completely removed from technology, completely removed from all the things that we spend our time thinking about, talking about, contemplating, and just like bring it back to just like basic human connection over like, a hot cup of coffee, which is something that people have been connecting over for many, many years. So I don't know. You might see me pouring an espresso at some point in the future here. Let's not rule that out. That's probably what I would do, is something along the lines of running a coffee shop in my local town here.
Double espresso for me, please, Jesse. And if you want an advice for a new question, maybe you can ask people their roulette strategy. That could be an option, I think.
Love it.
Get the real answer out of them, yes. Awesome, Jesse. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, as per always, my friend, to have this conversation. I can't wait to see you next week in New York and continue on our lovely conversations here. And like always, my friend, I wish you all the best and looking forward to see all the upcoming success. And once again, congratulations on the fatherhood and all the best on that side too.
Thank you, my friend. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Pierre. Looking forward to seeing you next week. But now I'm going to go have a midday nap because that's what I do now since I don't get a full night's sleep. So thanks for a good chat as always today. And I'll see you next week, my friend. Safe travels.